Good afternoon. I call this hearing to order. I'd like to welcome our witness today, Director of the Federal Bureau of Investigations, James Comey. I would note that Director Comey appeared this morning before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Jim, I appreciate your appearing before us now and enduring a long day of congressional testimony. I know the vice chair has had an opportunity to have a bite at you, but she wanted one more, she told me. As we often conduct hearings in closed session, I'd like to take this opportunity to publicly commend the director and the men and women of the FBI for their outstanding efforts at keeping our country safe. It is due in no small part to FBI vigilance in concert with the intelligence community partners that our nation's enjoyed peaceful and a safe Independence Day celebrations this past weekend. Director Comey, as you're well aware, extremists fueled by anti-Western propaganda remain intent on inflicting harm on U.S. interests at home and abroad. Over the past year, we've witnessed the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, also referred to as ISIL or the Islamic State or Daesh, attempt to inspire a wide range of individuals to conduct attacks against innocent civilians. Largely as a result of ISIL's media savvy, the number of U.S.-based individuals in 2015 seeking to conduct attacks in the homeland or overseas to join ISIL has already exceeded the combined number of individuals attempting these activities in 2013 and 2014. Unfortunately, the threats facing our nation are not limited to terrorist actors. Foreign governments remain intent on stealing our country's most valuable trade, intellectual property, and national security secrets. The FBI is charged with confronting all these threats as well and is continually challenged by the capabilities and tradecraft employed by these nation-state actors. In addition to these fairly unique jurisdictional issues, the FBI conducts routine law enforcement investigations of drug trafficking, theft of government property, child pornography, robbery, extortion, murder, and the list goes on and on and on. These criminals are also turning to encrypted communications as a means of evading detection. These two issues that might at first glance appear unrelated are in fact closely linked. Communications between a terrorist organization's operational commanders and field soldiers require enabling technology. Communications before a foreign state and its spies also requires enabling technology. In both cases, the enabling technology used by terrorists and foreign state spies is increasingly secure, encrypted communications. Both of these adversaries are taking advantage of the rapid advances in secure communications that are employing advanced commercially available encryption. Director, as I understand the issue, even when law enforcement has the legal authority to intercept and access communications, pursuant to a court order, you may lack the technical ability to do so. This is what you've referred to and others have referred to as going dark. You've described it as one of the biggest challenges facing your agency and law enforcement generally. This challenge falls at the intersection of technology, law, freedom, and security. It results from the adoption of universal encryption. These applications are designed so that only the user has the key to decode their content. In these cases, when the FBI or any other law enforcement agency requests access to a user's communications via a lawful warrant, it is inaccessible or unreadable. It does not matter whether the user is a suspected terrorist, a child molester, a spy, or a drug trafficker. Law enforcement's blind and becoming so, and as a result, we're less safe. I, like all Americans, desire privacy. As Americans, we're guaranteed the right to secure pursuant to the Fourth Amendment in our persons, houses, papers, and effects. I'm also concerned, though, as are my fellow members, about the terrorist, counterintelligence, and other criminal threats to those very same things. I strongly believe that we must identify a solution that first protects American privacy, but also allows for lawful searches under valid court orders. Director Comey, you've said that the encryption now readily available, and I quote, is equivalent to a closet that can't be opened or a safe that can't be cracked, unquote. You've had an opportunity today to speak to the committee and to the American people and to convince us that in order to keep the American people safe, you need to be able to open the closet or to crack the safe. There are no easy answers, and we're embarking on what will be a robust debate that I think was initiated by you, and I think that's a good thing. Director, you wrote on Monday that part of your job is to make sure the debate is informed by a reasonable understanding of the cost. I look forward to your testimony, this discussion, and I appreciate you being here. Before I turn to the Vice Chairman for her remarks, I'd like to ask unanimous consent to enter several documents into the record. The first is the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory Technical Report dated July 6, 2015, entitled Keys Under Doormat. The second letter from the American Civil Liberties Union to the committee dated July the 7th, 2015, on the topic of this hearing. The third is a letter from the Business Software Alliance dated July the 8th, 2015, again to this committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee on the topic of today's hearing. And the fourth is a transcript of the director's remarks to the Brookings Institute dated October 16, 2014. Without objection, those four documents will be entered into the record. I now turn to the Vice Chairman for any remarks she might make.
Yeah, thanks very much, Senator, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for holding this hearing. There was a crowded hearing this morning in Judiciary, and I think the number of people here today is evidence that this is a subject of great interest. So I thank you for holding this open hearing. Director Comey, welcome again back to the committee. And let me just repeat what I said this morning in Judiciary. I want to thank you and the men and women of the FBI for really unparalleled service to protect this country and disrupt and prevent attacks. We are very grateful, and I hope you will say that to your people, so thank you. For a period last month, there were arrests almost every day as the Bureau worked to thwart attacks around the 4th of July holiday. Counterterrorism has been the top of the FBI's priority list since 9/11, and never has it included so many operations and threats to our country. The Assistant Attorney General for National Security, John Carlin, said last week in remarks in London that the United States government was running hundreds of counterterrorism investigations involving every United States state. In addition to the growth in the number of terrorist incidents, the nature of the threat has changed significantly. Hundreds and perhaps thousands of Americans here at home are in contact with ISIL members and affiliates, ranging from those taking direction to those who are inspired by ISIL messages on social media platforms. As you know, I have been particularly concerned about terrorist use of the internet to instruct, recruit, and inspire terrorism inside the United States. And you very graphically pointed that out, and I hope you will again this afternoon with what you said this morning. I believe that United States companies, including many founded and headquartered in my home state, have an obligation to do everything they can to ensure that their products and services are not allowed to be used to foment the evil that ISIL embodies. Last week, I read a lengthy feature in the New York Times. The title was ISIS and the Lonely American, which described in detail how ISIL members use Twitter and other services to recruit a young woman over months to support a militant brand of Islam and try to get her to marry an ISIL fighter and travel to Syria. As Director Comey notes in his opening statement, quote, the foreign terrorist now has direct access to the United States like never before, end quote. Foreign terrorist groups, as well as adversarial nation states today, have greater awareness of how the United States intelligence community conducts its business to collect intelligence needed to protect the people of this country and to inform national security decisions. This committee has heard from the FBI, the National Security Agency as late as yesterday afternoon, the National Counterterrorism Center about how terrorist groups in particular have moved to forms of communications that are harder or impossible for the intelligence community and law enforcement to access. The increased use of end-to-end strong encryption by both new and established communications companies has exacerbated this trend. I understand the need to protect records, and encryption is one way of doing so, especially in this area of cyber penetrations of our government and our private sector companies. Encryption is an important safeguard. That doesn't mean, however, that companies should configure their services in a way that denies them the ability to respond to a court warrant, a FISA order, or a similar legal process from the government. This is not a theoretical issue. The FBI has briefed this committee on cases where it knows of communications involving ongoing terrorists by ISIL inside the United States, but it has no way to obtain the content of those communications, even with a court order based on probable cause. It seems to me that if companies will not voluntarily comply with lawful court orders for information, then they should be required to be able to do so through legislation in a way that protects security of consumer data against unauthorized access. As Director Comey has said, we are not looking for a back door into American companies. We are looking to be able to use the front door. So I welcome today's hearing and look forward to the director's testimony on the ongoing threat of terrorism against the United States and the need to acquire lawfully and quickly information necessary to stop those threats from becoming real attacks. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Vice Chairman. For members, after the director's comments, members will be recognized for 5 minutes based upon their order of attendance today. And I would like to remind all members that we're in an open session, which is unusual. Therefore, I would ask you to be particularly careful in the questions that you ask. And I trust, Director, if in fact you have an answer that can't be given in an open session, you'll just tell the Vice Chairman and I that we'll carry this over to a closed session at an appropriate time, and we'll accommodate you on that. With that, let me turn it to you, Director Comey, for any of your comments that you'd like to make.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Madam Vice Chair, thank you for this opportunity. I really do like the use of the word conversation. I think this is a conversation we have to have as a country, and this is a great opportunity to have it, to begin having it. I sometimes hear people talk about the crypto wars, and we're fighting the crypto wars today. And I don't like that metaphor, because I don't feel like I'm fighting anything. I am not here to win anything. I am here, I hope, to explain the ways in which the change in technology and the change in which bad people are using technology affects the tools the American people, through this body, have given the FBI. I think we all care about the same things. We care deeply about the security of our information, of our health care, of our finances, of our innovation, of all the great things that travel over the internet. We all care about that. And I think we all care about public safety. We all care about the ability to keep the folks safe in this country. And so I don't see it as a war. I see it as an opportunity to talk about how one is in tension with the other and what should we do about it. I really do believe we stand at an inflection point that I felt not long after I became director, which is why I started talking about this, where the technology has moved to a place where encryption, which was always available over the last 20 years, has become the default. And that change has been accompanied by an explosion in apps that ride on the internet and offer end-to-end encrypted communication. Those things have put us at an inflection point, most obviously given my primary responsibility with respect to counterterrorism. But this committee knows from closed sessions what I think the American people may know less well, which is the terrorism threat today is very, very different and has changed just in my almost 2 years as director. It is not the Al-Qaeda of old. The Al-Qaeda of old was interested in the multi-pronged, national landmark-based careful, long-planned attack with carefully vetted operatives. We still face that challenge. But the Al-Qaeda of old was very different from what we see today. And the Al-Qaeda of old wanted to proselytize, and it did so by posting magazines on websites. And if somebody wanted to consume propaganda, they found the website and they went and read the propaganda. And if they wanted to talk to a terrorist, they sent an email into the magazine, and maybe Anwar al-Awlaki would email you back. Here's what's changed. ISIL thinks about their terror in a very different way. They are not focused on the national landmark, multi-pronged, long-tail event. They want people to be killed in their name. And they're coming to us with that message, with their propaganda and their entreaty to action through Twitter and other parts of the social media. And that is a very different thing than Al-Qaeda ever did. They come into our country through thousands and thousands of followers of ISIL tweeters who are based in Syria. They have a physical safe haven. And so they broadcast a message, which is two-pronged. Come to the Islamic State, right? Join us here in this, our version of paradise, which is a nightmare, but their version of paradise. And second, if you can't come, kill somebody where you are, videotape it. If you can cut their head off and videotape it, great. Please try to kill law enforcement or military. Here's a list of names where you could kill somebody. And this message is pushed and pushed and pushed. Social media companies are worth billions of dollars because pushing to someone's pocket, whether you're selling shoes or cars or terror, works, right? ISIL has invested in this for about the last year, and they have about 21,000 English language followers right now. And they're pushing this message. It's as if a devil sits on someone's shoulder all day long saying, kill, kill, kill. And the terrorist, if you want to talk to them, is right there in your device. And so they're reaching and they're calling and they're calling, and it's having an effect on troubled souls in the United States. As the vice chair said, I have hundreds of these investigations in every single state, and we have disrupted, just in the last few weeks, very serious efforts to kill people in the United States. The challenge to us is, ISIL will find the live ones on Twitter, and then we can see them say, okay, here is my encrypted end-to-end mobile messaging app contact information. Contact me there. And so our task to find needles in a nationwide haystack becomes complicated by the fact that the needle at that moment goes invisible, right? I know I'm giving information to bad people. We cannot break strong encryption, right? I think people watch TV and think the Bureau can do lots of things. We cannot break strong encryption. So even if I get a court order under the Fourth Amendment to intercept that communication as it travels over the wires, I will get gobbledygook. That needle will remain dark to me. That is a big, big problem for us. And the second way in which this is enormously challenging is ISIL does something Al-Qaeda would never imagine. They test people by tasking them. Kill somebody, and then we'll see whether you really are a believer. And these people react in ways that are very difficult to predict. What you saw in Boston was what the experts call flash to bang being very close, right? In Boston, you had a guy who was in touch in an encrypted way with these ISIL recruiters, and we believe was bent on doing something on July 4th. He woke up one morning, June 2nd, and decided he was going to go kill somebody, right? Thank goodness we were able to confront him. He confronted our people with a knife, and unfortunately they had to use their weapons. But that's an example of sort of the unpredictability of this. So you combine the blindness with this broad reach and that flash to bang, and we face a challenge that we've not seen before. This is not your grandfather's Al-Qaeda. This is a very new threat that we face. Now, some people say to me, well, you have all kinds of other information you can get. We live in the golden age of surveillance. And I think of it differently. I think we live in the golden age of communication. Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden would never have dreamed that he could speak simultaneously to hundreds of Americans, find them and task them in ways that American law enforcement could not see, and do it at the speed of light. The golden age of communication is posing enormous challenges for us. I'm not here to scare folks, though. I'm here to tell people there is a problem. I do not know the answer. Right? A whole lot of good people have said it's too hard. Right? We can't have any diminution in strong encryption to accomplish public safety, else it'll all fall down and there'll be a disaster. And maybe that's so. But my reaction to that is, I'm not sure that we've really tried. I think Silicon Valley is full of great people who, when they were younger, were told your dreams are too hard. They were standing in a garage someplace. They were told can't be done. Thank goodness they didn't listen. Right? I think we have the talent to think about this in a good way. My hope from this conversation is that folks will realize this really matters. And the FBI is not the source of innovation. We're just telling people we got to talk about this because I see the present and I see the future, which in many ways is more troubling because the logic of it is inexorable. FBI is not some occupying force imposed on the American people from abroad. We belong to the American people. We only have the tools that they have given us through you. I'm here to tell the American people the tools you've given us are not working the way you expect them to work in the highest stakes matters. I need help figuring out what to do about that. The companies are run by good people. I think they see the challenge. They want to help. We have to figure out a way to solve this, to crack this riddle. And maybe it's too hard. Maybe we end up in that place. But I think this country has never been made up of people who say, can't be done. We really ought to talk about it more. So I appreciate the opportunity to discuss it with the committee.
Director, thank you. And I think it's safe to restate that we're at the start of the debate, even though we have had the conversations for some time privately. We've watched encryption grow more dominant and more dominant, and really, as you said, become the default. It's almost automatic now, and it places a huge challenge on your ability to fulfill your mandate, and our challenge is to work with you as a extension of the American people to provide you what tools America is comfortable with. And I think as we go through this debate, we'll figure out where that sweet spot is. With that, I'm going to turn to the Vice Chairman for her questions. And I would share with the members, it would be Feinstein, Wyden, Heinrich, Cotton, Coates, Hirono, Mikulski, Collins, Warner, McCain, Blunt, and Langford in that order. Vice Chairman.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairman. Director Comey, I think you spoke very eloquently, but can you quantify this at all? Can you tell us how often the FBI, acting pursuant to a warrant or other lawful process, encounters encrypted information you cannot access?
Yeah, thank you, Senator Feinstein. The answer is I really can't at this point for a couple reasons. We're sort of at the beginning of this, and we're going to work to try and collect that data. But the other thing is, it's a bit of like proving a negative. When my folks see that something is encrypted, they move on and try and find some other way to assess this bad guy or this potential bad guy. And so we obviously have incidents. The courts have collected incidents where wiretaps were issued by courts and then encryption was encountered. But my numbers, I don't have good enough numbers yet.
Okay. I think it would be helpful if the department could gather some numbers to quantify this. The next question is, BSA, which is known as the Software Alliance, sent a letter to this committee and the Judiciary Committee stating that calls for weakened encryption, quote, can create artificial commercial disadvantages for United States companies and barriers to market access, end quote. I'd like to have your reaction to that statement.
First, I think, again, I'm not an expert. Public safety is my thing, but I think I take issue with the notion of weakening encryption. I also take issue with the whole backdoor notion. I think what smart people have told me is there are a number of companies already out there that use strong encryption on their data, including data in motion, that have the ability to access the data and comply with court orders. And they're able to do both in a pretty robust way in all different sectors, right? In the information, in the ISP world, as well as in finance and a bunch of other places. So I don't know that it's going to be a question of weakening encryption. It's simply going to be a way of figuring out how do we comply with a judge's order, we the company. And I don't think the government is, frankly, smart enough to be able to impose a one-size-fits-all solution. But I also think you're right that there are competitive and international implications in this, right? None of us want to do anything to damage the innovation of America. It's the great engine of this amazing country. And so I do think there are international implications that have to be considered. Every country that cares about the rule of law is grappling with this right now. All of them are trying to figure out a way to maximize safety on the internet right? Make sure there's strong encryption and maximize public safety and do it under the rule of law. Our friends in the UK are doing that right now. So I agree that there are implications to it internationally.
Well, and let me ask you to respond. This is another quote from this same letter. Requiring technology that provides law enforcement access to information also risks undermining the security of all electronic communications and digitally stored information, end quote. Would you comment on that? As I understand it, what you would be talking about is some kind of front door key?
Again, it's hard. My reaction to that comment is maybe. And if that's the case, well, I guess we're stuck. But I don't think the great innovative people of America have actually put their mind to this, frankly, because they haven't been incentivized to do so. But again, I believe there are companies that provide significant portions of our internet activity that have strongly encrypted data in motion and have the ability, because it's part of their business model, to see the data and comply with court orders.
So you're saying that some do and some don't.
Correct.
Is that what you're saying?
And somehow they've managed to do it without the entire system crashing or without their own business being materially vulnerable in some way. But look, here's how I understand it. There's no such thing as secure. Right? There's more secure and less secure. There's vulnerability in every system. The question is, so what can we do to maximize public safety that results in an acceptable level of security? And the answer is, I don't know, but I think a lot of smart people should talk to each other to try and figure that out.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wyden.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Director Comey, I very much share Chairman Burr's comment with respect to the respect we have for the men and women of the FBI. And you and I have policy differences on that matter, but we are not going to respect the men and women who work for you any less because of those differences. Every senator who serves on this committee understands that it is a dangerous world. And the challenge is to make sure that we pursue approaches that promote security while not diminishing our liberty. And too often, we haven't been able to achieve either. And I think as we start this debate, I want to emphasize how exactly we got here. Executive branch agencies are now dealing with a problem that they largely created. Senior officials made the choice to secretly twist the law to support an ill-conceived secret program that vacuumed up millions of phone and email records of law-abiding Americans. A number of us spent years warning what the consequences would be, but obviously public confidence was dramatically diminished. That led to a very serious public backlash. And in response to it, just as Senator Feinstein read, our hardware and software companies accelerated their efforts to provide customers with stronger protections. This obviously creates real challenges for you. But I will tell you, as of this morning, statements are being made that do not inspire a lot of confidence. You talk about the need to strike the right balance. There hasn't been a lot of balance in the past. And as of what I heard this morning, there still isn't too much balance in the so-called balance. The Deputy Attorney General, Ms. Yates, seemed to suggest this morning that companies should retain a stockpile of encryption keys for the government to access. Making this a mandatory requirement would obviously present huge problems, since any such stockpile would be vulnerable to compromise or abuse. In my judgment, a mandate like that would be a huge gift to foreign hackers and criminals. So what I want to do with my time for questions is put this into context on a matter we all care about up here, which is cybersecurity. And I've had companies in Oregon hacked for economic espionage, and my constituents are not alone. So on the topic of encryption and cybersecurity, has the executive branch done any analysis of the impact that a requirement for U.S. companies to build weaker encryption or stockpile these encryption keys would have on U.S. cybersecurity?
Not that I'm aware of, because that forms part of our concern that we not try to impose a solution. I didn't understand her to be saying, obviously I sat next to her, I didn't understand her to be saying that. I understood her to be saying the end state we want is that companies, however they choose to do it, will be able to comply with judges' orders, but that we don't want to impose a one-size-fits-all. We want companies to work with us to figure out what works for you, because it seems that some companies have figured out how to do it.
Well, she was suggesting, in my view, that there be a stockpile of these keys. She didn't want the government to have it, and once you're going down that route, I think it's trouble. Now, having said that you're not aware of any study, and that was my sense, is it fair to say that strong encryption improves cybersecurity and weaker encryption reduces cybersecurity?
Yes, strong encryption is great.
Okay. Now, if a stockpile of encryption keys was created somewhere, because I took Ms. Yates' comment to not be the government, but she wanted it somewhere. If you had a stockpile of these keys created somewhere, would you be able to guarantee that these keys would never be stolen by a hostile foreign actor?
The hypothetical stockpile of keys, surely not. But again, please don't understand me to be suggesting, nor should you listen to me if I suggest a technical solution. I don't know what the answer is.
Well, I think you're right. I think that based on my 14 years of service on this committee, I don't have a lot of confidence that a stockpile of these encryption keys, and as I say, I heard Ms. Yates said there ought to be some kind of arrangement to have these encryption keys somewhere, I'm not confident it wouldn't be compromised or abused. That's the flaw in the concept. We'll continue to have this debate. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Heinrich.
Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for holding a public hearing on this topic and giving us an opportunity to discuss these issues. If I had one critique, it would be that we're missing valuable insight from the technology, privacy, and constitutional liberties. Experts who also have valid concerns around these ideas, potential proposals. One of the things I would suggest is that we consider holding a follow-up public hearing where we can hear from some of those individuals as well, particularly in the technology space. And in the meantime, I ask unanimous consent that a number of letters and background materials that you did not include in your earlier unanimous consent be made part of the hearing record.
Without objection.
Let's see. Director Comey, this issue of losing access to encrypted communication is obviously complex, particularly from a technological point of view. And I guess I want to start by just commending you and, as I have, NSA Director Rogers for your willingness to address this publicly and to start the conversation. I think one of the challenges is that it's going to be very hard to address this issue without a specific technological proposal or fix to be able to discuss. And, back in the 1990s, we had a first crack at this, which really came apart at the seams once it became solidified around a particular piece of technology. And that's what I'm concerned about today. So, in the interest of time, I'm going to submit the rest of my opening statement for the record so I can get to a couple of questions. But I think that's going to be at the crux of this conversation for a while, is that we need to know what a potential fix looks like, or in the case of if there are examples, and I'll get to that in my questions, what those look like to be able to know whether a fix is really better or whether it creates inherent weaknesses that are exploitable by some of these very talented nefarious actors that you brought up in your testimony. As you know, yesterday, several respected computer and cybersecurity experts, people who are really well-renowned in the area of cryptography, released a report that effectively concluded that you can't reliably provide the government or anyone else with exceptional access to software applications without introducing some critical weaknesses in that encryption. Given your interest in this issue, and I hope you've had a chance to at least familiarize yourself with that report, You know, one of the things I'm concerned about here, I guess, is that it seems like government and the technology interests are sort of talking past one another and need to sit down and get at least the technology pieces of this on the table so that we can all agree that we're talking about the same thing. And I think it would be a mistake with regard to exceptional access to leave the solution to a Congress that I would argue is not always the best judge of all things technical. As you mentioned, there are a lot of people in Silicon Valley who are doing a really good job of trying to manage these things. So can you give some examples of programs that currently use some form of end-to-end encryption, so provide that security, but also are able to respond somehow to the law enforcement warrants that you need to put out there?
Yeah, thank you, Senator. And I agree very much, that which is why I'm so excited about this opportunity, to because I think things like this hearing will drive the conversation, because we need to do it together. They are the source of the innovation and the expertise. We need their help in solving this. I've never heard, until I read the executive summary and I went through that paper pretty quickly, the rest of it, I never heard the term exceptional access. My reaction when I read it is, I don't want exceptional access. I want ordinary access, where a judge issues an order and folks are able to comply with the order that a judge issues. There are providers who, because of their business model, encrypt the, as I understand, strongly encrypt the communications in motion, but they're visible to them on their servers that they control. And it's part of their business model, because they want to be able to sell you ads, and so they need to be able to see the content. And for those providers, some of whom are huge providers, we are able to serve a judge's order and get the content in a counterterrorism case or an espionage case or a serious criminal case of communications that the judge has authorized us to do. And I don't think those folks think that their system is materially vulnerable. And so I wonder, again, folks should not be looking to me for technical advice. I wonder whether that isn't an example that we should use in our conversations with the companies. But every company is going to be different, which is why I don't think one size fits all, because some of the companies at issue where the terrorists use are three guys in a garage who started this end-to-end encrypted app. And so our ability to work with them may be very different than with some bigger companies. So I don't think we want to be seen as, we're going to impose this fix on all of you. We want to talk to you about how we can solve this. I don't want to demonize the companies either. They love their country. They care about public safety. I know that from private conversations. And so it's about, we care about these two things. How do we maximize both of these? Maybe it's impossible. Maybe the scientists are right. I'm not ready to give up on that yet.
Well, we're over time here, so I'll wait for the second round. But I guess everybody has this concern about, you know, just having been one of the people who got a letter from OPM recently, that the government might not be the right folks to be holding the keys for end-to-end encryption. So we need to find a more elegant approach.
Agree.
Senator Cotton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Director, for being here to address this very important problem. Just to make sure I understand the issue here, what we're talking about is not some kind of extraordinary surveillance, not something that's unknown to the user of a device, but encryption technology that would thwart a lawful court order that has been taken in front of an independent federal or state judge by law enforcement authorities to get access to data. And then you go to a company, and that company says, sorry, we can't provide you this information because we have designed a system in a way that prevents us from accessing it.
That's correct. Or with respect to a device that's locked, and the same judge issues a search warrant, and they tell us we can't open it because we designed our system to make the phones, we cannot unlock them.
And this is the Intelligence Committee, but I know you testified in front of the Judiciary Committee this morning. This is an issue not just for terrorist operations, but I would presume also for things like child molesters, child pornographers, sex traffickers, kidnappers. Is that correct?
Yes. This is an overwhelming issue in local law enforcement and prosecution, especially the data that's on a device that can't be opened, because they tell me that's a feature of all of the cases you mentioned, as well as domestic violence, car accidents. The information on there can show you who the bad guy is, also tell you someone's not guilty. And so it's very important in all their work.
In one of the recent congressional recesses, I spent some time at the Little Rock field office for the FBI. And first, I want to commend the agents and employees you have at that field office there for their dedicated public service. It was a very important afternoon for me. They specifically brought up the going dark issue and the way it has thwarted their operations to keep Arkansans safe. Furthermore, I was able to see in their lab an effort they had made to get access to a locked device, and they got access, and it actually allowed them to recover a young girl who had gone missing. But they said that that was rare and that they were fortunate they were able to do it. I think that's just an example of what I suspect is the case, is that, in your opinion, in all 50 states of our union, is this an ongoing problem for both federal law enforcement and local law enforcement?
Yes.
Do the companies with whom you deal in private settings appreciate the fact that the technology that they are creating and marketing is being used by terrorists and some of the most heinous criminals in our society?
They do, and it bothers them, which is why I think we're starting to have more productive conversations, because they're good people.
So we're not the only society to encounter this kind of problem, of course. And one argument you hear from American companies is that they need to compete in the international market because most people don't live in the United States. Have you taken a look at how countries like, say, the United Kingdom or France have addressed this issue?
Yes, they're both grappling with it. They're both a little bit ahead of us. They both have passed legislation that, as I understand it, will require providers to give access, again, with appropriate authority in the course of investigations. So they're grappling with it just as we are. Everybody who cares about the rule of law and public safety, it has to grapple with the same thing.
So about 20 years ago, this Congress passed something called CALEA, the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, saying in the old days, essentially, on telephones, that telephone companies had to provide the ability to let law enforcement, with a lawful court order, put in a wiretap. Could you look to CALEA or maybe what other countries have done to address the going dark program with data encryption as a model for this Congress to act?
It's possible. I mean, it's one of the things that's being talked about. Is that a model that can be adapted to deal with this challenge? And so we're still working on that.
Okay.
By us, I mean not just in the government, but I think private sector has to be part of that conversation.
Does the executive branch yet have legislative proposals that they are prepared for this Congress to take under advisement?
Not yet.
Is that because you're continuing to work with some of these companies to try to develop the technical, legal, and policy frameworks?
Yes. Just as I think we all do, the president sees the problem, sees that these two things we care about tremendously are in tension and that it's a really hard problem. And so he's commissioned a whole lot of work on different streams, but one of them is to figure out what legislation, if we decide to go that route, would make sense, and to get the input from the private sector. And so what would work for you folks?
Well, thank you very much, Director, for your testimony. Thank you very much for what you represent, the tens of thousands of agents around the country who keep us safe on days like the 4th of July and every day. I just urge you and the men and women with whom you work in the executive branch to get us that kind of proposal as quickly as possible. We all recognize the tension between trying to protect data, which we want to do for American citizens, but also ensure that law enforcement has the tools they need, not just to stop terrorism, but stop the most heinous kinds of crimes imaginable in our society.
Senator Coates.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, you were having, I think, a very worthwhile discussion, and I appreciate your being here. And also your open-mindedness in terms of finding humility, in a sense, in saying we don't know all the answers, but there are a lot of cooperative and smart people out there that can help us find the answers and hopefully attain that balance between privacy and that balance between protecting people's lives. I don't envy you your job because every day I pick up the paper or turn on the television and the news, and there's an abducted child, there's a criminal act, there is a threat from terrorist threats from abroad, and the American public is demanding that your agency do everything possible to prevent that from happening, to recover that child, to address the blatant use of communication devices and so forth and so on that result in very, very bad criminal acts. By the same token, you get hit from the other side by saying, but don't you dare do anything that would give you that could potentially be used to violate someone's privacy. And so that's a very narrow path to try to walk down and achieve both of those goals. And I think your statement relative to the fact that we need to turn to those very people that are providing the encryption in order to protect people's privacy, are part, a very essential part of the solution. My question here, though, is that while we can make patriotic requests to all these technical companies, Silicon Valley, in other words, to help us through this, and there are patriotic Americans that say, yes, let's see if we can find that sweet spot, we also know that there are countries around the world that have no intent of helping us whatsoever. And within those countries, or even some of those lawless areas, like you mentioned, in terms of ISIL occupying physical territory, the last thing they're going to want to do is cooperate with us in terms of finding a solution to this particular problem. And so it would be very easy, that turns us to the difficulty of no matter how much we do, we're a global communications system in place. And it's easily to turn somewhere else. We've seen offshore gambling because we pass laws say you can't do gambling on the internet here in the United States, and they simply find an island in the Caribbean and set up, and through the ether there it goes. So I'm wondering how you can continue to have the agency perform its role without some type of authority to allow you to, of course, within the legal system, address the problem. And obviously it's going to take time to develop any kinds of solutions. What do you have to do relative to manpower costs to fill the gap between now and then?
Well, thank you, Senator. And I should have said this earlier to thank the entire committee, but Senator Cotton and you, Senator Coates, reminded me, thank you for the nice things you said about the folks at the FBI. I sent them all a note, an email before July 4th saying, thank you. The American people I know are grateful. I know that you're bone tired. My folks are bone tired, but they stopped the stuff that was trying to come at us for July 4th. But now it's July 7th and 8th, and they're on to the next thing. So thank you for that. I'm going to pass it along to them. It means a lot to them. We love walking that fine line, right, between public safety and privacy and civil liberties, right, because we care. We got families. We care about the same stuff. So we like walking that line. We do agree that there's an international component to this, as you said, Senator, that we're going to have to address. The folks, especially in Western Europe and here in North America, who care about the things that we care about, we have to figure out an approach together that makes sense. But America is the big dog, right? The innovation is here, the energy is here, the infrastructure is here. What we do will set the tone and the pattern for the rest of the world. We can't fix the whole world, but for the world that thinks about things the way we do, values what we do, we can drive it. But that doesn't mean it's an easy thing. We try to fill the gap by, if I can't see the communications of a terrorist, then I got to figure out, okay, can I get an informant in on him? Can I send an undercover in? Can I follow him 24/7 for weeks and weeks and see if I turn something up? All I'm telling folks is we'll keep doing it. My folks will keep working no matter how tired they are. It's just the tools the American people thought we had are being diminished, and I see that only continuing.
Well, I think we all look forward to working with you to try to achieve that goal. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rona.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Director, for your work and, of course, all of the people who work for the FBI in protecting the safety of our citizens. I'd like to get a little bit more of information of where we are now in terms of your ability to see information. And, for example, in how many cases have you sought a warrant for a device or a wire that has been thwarted, completely thwarted by encryption? And how many federal investigations have been unable to progress because of encryption?
Yeah, the answer, as I said earlier, Senator Rono, I don't know the answer to that. We're going to try and see if there's data we can collect on that. I'm not confident it's going to be very reliable for you, though, because what our investigators do is if they see someone's on an app that we know is encrypted, they're not going to bother seeking a wiretap for that. So we won't be able to count that, I don't think, as a wiretap thwarted. And if we see encryption, we just try and find another way to assess the situation. We try and use the other tools. We're going to try and do that for you, but I'm not optimistic we're going to be able to get you a great data set. There's no doubt that it is a real feature of our life. I think that's one thing everybody should be able to agree upon, right? The logic of this is all of our papers and effects, all of our communications will at some point be covered by strong encryption. I hope everybody agrees that will have profound consequences for law enforcement.
I think that's one of the reasons that we have to be very careful in what we decide to do. And so it always helps to define the extent of the problem and the current situation. And then, as you say, no system is secure, so we need to weigh the what the risks mm-hmm. are, et cetera, because at the same time, we have this very august group who have said that forcing companies to provide a backdoor to encryption is going to result in a lot of unintended, possibly, consequences, including we're told that some of our companies will lose a competitive advantage because, for example, if we expand Kalia to include encrypted apps, that Kalia only would apply to our companies, and therefore if our companies have to provide a sort of a backdoor way to get to this information and foreign companies who are in the marketplace don't, then they are at a competitive disadvantage. So there are a lot of issues that we do have to weigh. And speaking of Kalia, by the way, did I understand you to say that expanding Kalia is just one of the things on the table? Because I thought you had said at another forum, perhaps, that you think Kalia should be expanded to include encryption apps.
I don't know whether I said that, but if I said it, I'm smarter today than I was then. I think that's something that folks are discussing, but I don't know what that answer is. That's why we haven't come to the hearing with a proposal. We're trying to show the humility to say we actually don't know what will be best. But I agree with the competitive harm point, Senator.
As we wrestle with this subject, though, and meanwhile, the companies are providing more and more encryption apps, I mean, at what point do you think that we'll be prepared to take some sort of legislative action that would enable you to get access to information and yet still provide our companies with the kind of environment that they would like us to provide?
I don't know.
What is the time frame?
I don't know, because I do think this is one of the most complicated problems I've ever seen in government for the reasons that I've alluded to here, including what you said about competitive harm. We do not want to damage the engine of innovation that is America. Mm-hmm. And so we have to figure out, so how can we maximize safety on the internet and public safety in a way that makes sense for America? Now, it probably makes sense. We ought to figure out what kind of people we want to be first, what makes sense for our country. But I do think we got to do that in league with international partners so that we don't create a situation where America is the only mover and that causes harm to our companies.
I think that is a very important aspect of what we need to do going forward on the going dark problem, because it would be very unfair to our companies, as you say, if we're the only country that requires a backdoor way to this information. So I'm glad that that's on the table mm-hmm. In our discussions with our with other countries. So the president's review group, that's some other people have already mentioned, but they said very strongly that we should not require a backdoor way. So in these discussions, is the technical, you know, technology companies, are they going to be at the table as we discuss going forward and what might be appropriate legislative action?
They have to be, because I think we all think no one size fits all, so you got to figure out what would work for different companies. And as I said before, I think that is the source of the innovation. That is the source of the creativity that we have to harness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Mikulski.
Mr. Director, it's very nice to see you again. Mr. Chairman, thank you for having this hearing, as well as the Vice Chair. I'd like to pick up on Senator Heinrich's recommendation about an additional hearing on this subject from the technical and civil liberties folks. In our briefing materials, I read letters from the ACLU, whose views we so value, the Software Alliance, and I saw a lot of criticism of what we're pursuing here for some type of opportunity to not go dark. But I didn't see any solutions. I saw a lot of criticisms, a lot of critiques, but I didn't see solutions. Now, I believe again, as Senator Heinrich said and others, we have tremendous technical know-how. And I believe that the people in Silicon Valley are indeed very patriotic people, and they don't want drug dealers and international traffickers and child pornographers to be able to get away with nefarious things. So if we could actually perhaps get from those, as well as the civil liberties community, how we can start working to a solution, that would be great. Mr. Director, in this year's appropriations funding, we worked very hard to support you, both when I was chair of the subcommittee that funds you, as now Senator Shelby. We have now put in $8.4 billion to fund you for this coming year, and we also put in $483 million for cybersecurity. My question to you is, do you feel that those resources and the type of workforce you have is able to be flexible enough to meet the ongoing threat? This is a no, I'm not being critical of what you have, but as you talk about the recruitment tools of ISIL, who are pretty talented using Twitter and other forms of social media, that's a whole different generation. And it's a whole different generation than the original cyber warriors that were hired under your predecessor. So do you feel you have enough resources to be able to recruit the people needed to deal with this, as well as the administrative flexibility to bring in teams? This is not going to be your traditional agent. Could you share with us, because we can have the best law in the world, but unless you have the best workforce and the flexibility and the resources to hire it, we're just creating hollow opportunities.
Well, thank you, Senator. I think the answer is yes and no. Yes, I believe that this Senate and this Congress is giving us the resources I need for next year, the money I can responsibly spend, but I face a threat, obviously, that continues to grow, so I will be back to ask for additional help. But I think you have given us what we can reasonably spend, reasonably invest in, and I think the answer is yes. I think I can attract the talent. I cannot compete on DOE, but the value proposition is totally different. If you're interested in DOE, you don't want to work at the FBI. And that's, you don't come here to get rich, but so many young people want to make a difference in the life of this country that they don't care about the DOE. They want to be part of addressing these threats. That's pretty exciting. And so I'm optimistic, actually. Now, once I get them in and they're here 5-6 years, start to have a family and there's no cost of living adjustment, maybe I start to lose their enthusiasm a little bit, but that's a problem I'll deal with down the road. I got lots of smart young folks wanting.
But what about the flexibility? So here, you investigate breaches and a variety of things. You're also counterterrorism. That's the social media world that you're now operating in. Even a modern director, like Director Mueller, did not face what you had. He faced Al-Qaeda. You face a variety of other challenges, as you so clearly said. Do you have the administrative flexibility to bring on people as you need them that might not be the traditional trade routes for recruitment of FBI personnel?
I think so. There's a couple of things around that I'm thinking about. But in the main, the answer is yes. One of the things we have to consider is, should we look at a different career proposition for people? Have them come. Once people come to the FBI, they almost never leave. They get addicted to it. But should there be a model where they come, and then they go and do something in the private sector, then come back? That's something we haven't done before. But that may be a model I want to look at. But in the main, yes. You've given me the flexibility.
My last question, and I think perhaps it's not appropriate to an open session. So we have three so-called coincidences today. The fact that the technology has failed at United Airlines, the New York Stock Exchange, as well as the Wall Street Journal. I don't believe in coincidence. I believe a coincidence is an event that we don't have an explanation for. Is the FBI investigating these as breaches, or have you not been called in, or are you not able to say? I was very troubled.
Yeah, as was obviously that caught my attention. We're not big believers in coincidence either. We want to dig into that, but we've been involved in contact with all three companies to understand what's going on, and we do not see any indication of a cyber breach or cyber attack. Actually, I think the Wall Street Journal piece is connected to people flooding their website in response to the New York Stock Exchange to find out what's going on. But it looks, again, in my business, you don't love coincidences, but it does appear that there is not a cyber intrusion involved.
Thank you very much, Mr. Director.
Senator Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, you've talked about the impact on terrorism cases and your counterterrorism efforts, and you've said that it's very difficult to quantify what the impact is. But it's my understanding that this morning, in testimony before the Judiciary Committee, that the district attorney for Manhattan said that in the past 6 months alone, there had been 74 cases where law enforcement had been stymied because they were unable to get information from lawfully seized cell phones. Is that accurate?
I saw that in the written testimony of District Attorney Vance, and so knowing him, I believe it to be accurate.
As I look at this problem, which obviously has ramifications, as some of my colleagues have pointed out, for criminal cases as well as for counterterrorism investigations, would an option be to require the companies themselves to be able to access the information to comply with a lawful court order, not the government having the keys or a back door in, but the company itself? Might that be a solution to this problem?
Yes, and that's something the Deputy Attorney General talked about this morning, that it's possible to imagine a world where the companies figure out how to comply in a way that maximizes security of their information and complies with the judge's order, and that every company does it in a slightly different way. Yes, that's a possible outcome.
Now, there are most companies, I suspect, that are involved in developing this end-to-end encryption did so with the best of intentions. They were trying to increase the security of the data of their customers. But do you believe that there are some companies that have intentionally developed this kind of system in order to thwart their ability to respond to a lawful court order?
I don't know with respect to the intent question. I know there are companies that have, once they made the decision, advertised it as a solution that would be immune to a search warrant. Apple did that when they rolled out their new phone. But I don't know that the intention of the original change was to accomplish that result, if that distinction makes sense.
Well, it doesn't to me, because if a company is advertising that the information would be safe from a search warrant, that's very troubling to me, because that, to me, implies an intent to keep information away from law enforcement despite the issuance of a lawful court order. And I think most people involved in the encryption process and developing these products would not want to thwart law enforcement, whether it's for criminal case or terrorism. But that kind of advertising does trouble me, and I won't ask you to respond to that. I do want to switch to access to a different kind of information that suggests how much we need a computer, a cybersecurity law. I just met with the CEO of a large bank. He relayed to me an incident where the FBI knew that his bank had been targeted for a cyber attack. Here's what he told me had to happen. He said that the FBI, under current law, could not immediately go to this bank and convey the information. First, they had to go to the bank regulators, the OCC regional office. Then the information had to go from there to the OCC in Washington. From there, it had to go to the Department of Homeland Security. Then the Department of Homeland Security approved the FBI contacting the bank to warn them of this imminent attack. Well, obviously, and he said this all occurred over a weekend, so it was difficult to reach people, there were cell phones involved, et cetera. That's a terrible system. And we need to be able to empower the FBI in real time to be able to notify a financial services organization, the electric grid, the air traffic control system, critical infrastructure of an impending attack. Would you agree with that?
Very much. And what you've described surprises me, because I think the way we operate is we call them. If there's a threat to an institution of any kind, we've developed relationships with their chief information security offices. So what I'm going to go back and track. Maybe you can privately give me the information.
I will privately tell you.
Because it's not the way I understand it works or is supposed to work.
Well, this incident really troubles me, because by the time the information got to the proper people at the bank, it is nothing short of a miracle that the cyber attack hadn't already occurred. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Warner.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Comey, good to see you again. And let me add my comments to my colleagues about the good work that you and the people of the FBI do. Building on Senator Collins' comment, I think, again, even if this was a one-off, the notion that there's not clarity in a single point of contact speaks volumes about the need to at least take forward the legislation that this committee passed in a bipartisan way and at least take a first step. It's not going to solve all the problems, but I think would be a significant step forward. Having some technology background, I've had some conversations with companies in the IT space and the encryption space who, once they've created some of this entity, are, I think, in a sense, are starting to understand the potential problems that are being created. Can you speak to any of that in terms of a recognition that under the guise of either privacy or better business protections, of a growing recognition within particularly the IT community that this is a very much a double-edged sword and may have created a monster that is not controllable?
Yeah, thank you, Senator. I meant what I said. I think they're good people, and it's not their job to worry about public safety. And so I don't think it's something that's front and center for them. I think what's happened is, particularly this ISIL threat and how real it is and everywhere, has focused them. And so they see it. And so we're having productive conversations. Again, they don't want people to die. They don't want kids to get kidnapped. These are regular folks. And so that's why I'm excited about the prospect of harnessing that innovation. They are good people who want to have successful businesses, and they want to protect their country. And so, again, I'm not a naysayer. I know I hear people write papers that say it's just too hard, and I'm not buying that, because I don't think the great people of Silicon Valley and other places have said, you know what, let's see what we can do in a way that protects that which we have built and that the country in which we live.
Well, I can, Mr. Chairman, I just say I've got a series of these companies in Virginia, and when the 100-plus military personnel and their families' names were publicized in an attempt to intimidate, I think it woke up, at least in the Commonwealth of Virginia, a lot of IT companies about the notion of how very real and how obscene some of the actions that this ISIL group is in terms of threatening people. Let me move to Senator Mikulski asked the question I was hoping to ask about the three events today, and I hope you will get back to us. But I want to raise another issue that I think there has been a great deal of confusion around and concern, and that's the OPM breach. We're literally months into this now and continue to get a series of different answers in terms of numbers. I've been very disappointed by OPM's reaction and post-breach in terms of assuring those federal employees, current and past, both in terms of what actions the government's going to take to protect them going forward and some of the subcontractors they've been using and how ill-equipped they've been. Not your topic, but if you can perhaps give a little more clarity about the overall scope of that attack within the confine or within the context of this public hearing. There's an awful lot of people listening for those kind of answers.
And it's something I have to approach carefully in an open hearing. And I know that the administration, OPM in particular, is working and is close to offering a more public and more detailed accounting of what we think was lost, but it is an enormous breach and a huge amount of data that is personal and sensitive to federal employees, former federal employees, people who applied for federal employment, was available to the adversary, and we have to assume that it was looked at and or exfilled. So we're talking about millions and millions of people affected by this. And the challenge of it is, it's not just, I'm sure the adversary has my SF-86 now. My SF-86 lists every place I've ever lived since I was 18, every foreign travel I've ever taken, all of my family, their addresses. So it's not just my identity that's affected. It's, you know, I got siblings, I got five kids, I got all of that is in there. And so the numbers quickly grow far beyond the number of federal employees, which is millions over the last 20 years. And so it is a very, very big number. It is a huge deal.
And I understand active investigation, but I also know that we're now running on 60-plus days, actually more than a year since the first breach, and the lack of a single answer or even some sense of that answer overall from the administration is very troubling. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator McCain. John, cut on that microphone, would you?
Is it true that you have stated on several occasions that ISIS poses over time a direct threat to the United States of America?
Yes.
And that is the case today?
Yes. Every day they're trying to motivate people here to kill people on their behalf.
And every day that they take advantage of this use of the Internet, which you have described by going to unbreakable methods of communicating, the more people are recruited and motivated to, here in the United States and other countries, to attack the United States of America. Is that true?
Yes, sir.
So this is not a static situation. This is a growing problem as ISIS makes very effective use of the Internet. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir.
So in all due respect to your opening comments, this is more than a conversation that's needed. It's action that's needed. And isn't it true that over time, the ability of us to respond is diminished as the threat grows and we maintain the status quo?
I think that's fair.
So we're now, and I've heard my colleagues with all due respect talking about attacks on privacy and our constitutional rights, et cetera, but it seems to me that our first obligation is the protection of our citizenry against attack, which you agree is growing. Is that a fact?
With respect to the, I agree that that is our first responsibility. I also agree
so
that
the status quo is not acceptable if we support the assertion that our duty is to protect the lives and property of our fellow citizenry as our first priority. Is that, you agree with that?
I agree that this is something we have to figure out what to do about.
So now we have a situation where the major corporations are not cooperating and saying that if we give the government access to their Internet, that somehow it will compromise their ability to do business. Is that correct also?
I think that's a fair summary of what some have said.
So we're discussing a situation in which the U.S. government, i.e. law enforcement and the intelligence community, lack the capability to do that which they have the authority to do. Is that correct?
Certainly with respect to the interception of encrypted communications and accessing locked devices, yes.
So we're now in an interesting situation where your obligation is to defend the country And at the same time, you are unable to do so because these telecommunications, these organizations are saying that you can't and are devising methodology which prevents you from doing so if it's the single key only used by the user. Is that correct?
I wouldn't agree, Senator, that I'm unable to discharge my duty to protect the country. We're doing it every single day using all kinds of tools.
Are you able to have access to those systems that which only have one key?
No, we can't break strong encryption.
So you can't break it. And that is a mechanism which is installed by the manufacturer to prevent you from using that there's only one key that is available to them, to you.
That's correct.
So suppose that we had legislation which required two keys, one for the user and one that, given a court order, requiring court order, that you would be able to, with substantial reason and motivation for doing so, would want to go into that particular site. What's the problem with that?
Well, a lot of smart people, smarter than I certainly, say that would have a disastrous impact on broader security across the internet, which is also part of my responsibility to
fight.
Do
you believe that?
I'm skeptical that we can't find a solution that overcomes that harm. But a lot of serious people say, you don't realize you'll rush into something and it'll be a disaster for your country because it'll kill your innovation, it'll kill the internet. That causes me to at least pause and say, okay, well, let's talk about it.
Yeah, but we've just established the fact that ISIS is rushing into attempting to harm America and kill Americans, aren't we?
They are.
So I say, with respect to my colleagues and their advocacy for our constitutional obligations and rights, that we are facing a determined enemy who is, as we speak, according to you and the Director of Homeland Security, seeking to attack America, destroy America, and kill Americans. So it seems to me that the object should be here is to find a way not only to protect Americans' rights, but to protect American lives. And I hope that you will devote some of your efforts, and I hope this committee, and I hope the Congress will, understand the nature of this threat and to have to say that we can't protect Americans' constitutional rights and at the same time protect America is something that I simply won't accept. I thank you, Director Comey.
Senator Blunt.
Thank you, Director. Thank you for being here and thank you for the work you do. Following up on the comments that Chairman McCain made, what are we really focused on here? The recruitment of somebody who's not already in a terror network? And the reason I'm asking this, it seems to me that if you want to use encrypted equipment from some other country, and two of you were committed to do that, you could do that. I mean, when I'm out of the country, I can get on the internet, the wireless out of the country, the wireless network, use the equipment that I took with me, which is certainly not something I purchased there. So what I'm asking is, even if we did something about encryption here, I'm no technical expert, but it seems to me that wouldn't stop two people who plan to communicate with each other on devices they got somewhere else from doing that. Is there something here I don't understand about that? And then the other part of the question is, or is our real target here to monitor the recruiting efforts or the internal efforts of people who aren't in a terror network but are talking in the United States among themselves about doing terrorist things?
Thank you, Senator. The recruitment tends to take place in a way that we, with lawful process, can see it, either usually on Twitter or Twitter direct messaging, mm-hmm. which are not encrypted. Mm-hmm. And then, if it looks productive to the ISIL recruiters, they move them to the end-to-end encrypted communication. And so a major concern is, what are the guys in Syria telling these guys, and what are they telling them back? And what are they saying to their buddies using encrypted platforms within the United States? So it's both the international, right, and the local within a network in the United States.
I guess what I'm asking is, if the international encrypted equipment is still available, is there anything we can do that stops that from being a problem that you can't penetrate?
I think the answer is, again, I'm not an expert, if the servers are located entirely outside the United States, that we would have a heck of a time enforcing a regime that would require them to give us access. Now, I suppose an expert might say to you, well, but if it transits the United States, there's some way we can impose our will on it. I just don't know well enough to evaluate that. So I do think one of the challenges that people have raised with this is, say, even if we fix our problem, you have to address it in some fashion internationally, because the really bad guys will move to infrastructure that is in Western Europe. And so to solve your problem, people say, America's got to get its act together, and it's the big dog, so you probably ought to do it first. Then your colleagues and allies in Western Europe have to get their act together to make sure there isn't a safe haven there. Now, that still leaves you with people who might want to move their infrastructure to some other less well-governed part of the world. So you're always going to have a small part of that problem, but I think the main part of the problem could be dealt with North America and Europe focusing on it.
And is Europe focusing on it?
Yes. I think I said earlier, the UK and France are a little bit ahead of us on this, French in particular, in the wake of Charlie Hebdo, and the Brits. Both, as I know the British better, have legislation that requires access to communications. Their challenge is the reverse of what you're saying. The infrastructure is in the United States on which they want to compel access. And so trying to figure out how to deal with that is a challenge we're still working through.
And so the infrastructure is really the target, as opposed to the device somebody might be using, even if the device is encrypted. What infrastructure it goes through may or may not accept that encrypted message.
Well, I think the reason I was talking about the infrastructure is that would give you the ability to compel some, to impose a requirement that provider, the owner of that infrastructure that sits in your country, comply with American law to give judicial orders, make them effective. Right. The challenge is, if the infrastructure is not in the United States, who are you compelling to give the judge's order effect?
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm joining the group that's suggesting we have a more technical, not to diminish either your ability in this area or mine, that we have, and probably in a closed session, so we could ask questions without being concerned about anybody telling us something that everybody in the world doesn't necessarily need to know, so we'd understand this. But I think we have a bigger problem than we can deal with on our own. And to fight a big fight here that is easily evaded by somebody who wants to evade it would be of concern to me. But in conjunction with others who are perhaps even ahead of us on this, I think the director makes a good point that we need to be sure we all understand.
I assure the senator that Senator Feinstein and I were up conversing already about how we put together another hearing, if not a series of hearings, to try to get into this a little bit deeper and to better understand, along with the director, what our options might be as we proceed forward. This is something I would recommend to all the members that they become educated in on a periodic basis, because this is not the end of technological advances. Therefore, it's not this is not the last challenge we're going to be faced with from a technology standpoint. Senator Lankford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you're right. This is not the last one we're going to deal with. This is the latest technological battle we're going to deal with. Director Comey, thank you for all your work, and please pass on to the folks that worked some very long hours leading up to July the 4th our appreciation for what they did for the nation and for the citizens of my state and people all around the country. We do appreciate their work very much, and you have a terrific team. The challenge that we face on this is not only the technology side in dealing with terrorism, it's also the benefit that is gained from this.
I would tell you the folks at OPM would be glad to talk about encryption and the value of that right now if they'd have kept their data in a more encrypted location and stored it better and had greater security on this, whether that be retailers around the country, whether that be banks, whether it be government agencies. We are benefiting from encryption and from the technology that has been invented. The hard part of this is the other side of it. And so what I'd like to talk is we've got to have some kind of balance in the conversation, because we absolutely need encrypted technology, because we are very exposed and are finding out all the ways that our information is exposed. And so we need that technology to continue to advance on one side as we deal with cybersecurity, but on basic law enforcement and on real threats for physical security, we've got to have a different ability. And I think that's the complicating factor of this. With that, in that conversation, talk to me a little bit about some legal frameworks here. If someone goes on social media and they have child pornography, that's a criminal issue. If someone goes on to social media and says, here's a group of people to kill, and we'd like you to kill them, and here's some ideas to do that. Talk to me about the legal frameworks between the two, because there's a step before this when they move encryption, that is the recruiting, and that recruiting side is a group of individuals that are recruiting based on, we're looking for people who actively believe like we do, which is not the problem, but then we'll also act out and kill people. Help me understand some of the legal frameworks there.
Well, if someone is on social media talking about the possibility or offering any kind of criminal activity, which includes terrorism, because it's a criminal act,
right,
as well, that's obviously predicate for an FBI investigation, and for us using our lawful tools, including judicial orders, to find out what's going on there and who are these people.
Okay, so that, I'm really talking the step before that then, and that's what you and I are talking about now. That social media side of that, what does that trigger at that point, or does that, you begin the investigation, you begin the process, obviously, of trying to track this down, because they're encouraging a criminal act on American soil.
Yep.
But then you've got extra communication that's happening now in the encrypted level.
Yes.
Is that what I'm picking up?
Right. What's happening is they're broadcasting out this poison through, right, Twitter. They have 21,000 followers now in English, and they'll have Twitter following communication, so tweets back and forth. And then they may have direct messaging through Twitter, all of which, again, with lawful process, we can get access to and evaluate. And if it looks like someone, and here's the way ISIL operates, if the person appears to be serious, they will then say, okay, move to this mobile messaging app, which is encrypted end-to-end. And that's when we lose them. And so, and we have, as I said earlier, we have no ability, if we intercept that mobile messaging app data traveling back and forth, we can intercept the data, but it's gobbledygook, and we can't break that encryption.
Right. Yeah, that part I understand.
Okay.
So the social media platforms, they still see no issue once it's clearly known that this is an illegal activity that's happening on their platform. Is their response to say, you can't do that on our platform, or their response is, hey, we're just open for anything, whether it's prostitution, child porn, or terrorism, you can use it?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood the
sorry.
Question, Senator. They're being quite good about this, frankly, and it's gotten increasingly good over the last year. Twitter does not want people engaging in soliciting advertising, criminal activity of any sort on their social media platform, but they're being particularly aggressive at shutting down and trying to stop ISIL-related sites. I think it actually led ISIL to threaten to kill their CEO, which helped them understand the problem in a better way. And so it's a they are being quite good about that.
Okay. And then you've alluded twice now to the UK and France are a little bit ahead of us on this. And then you said that they're discussing this. Can you give us greater detail to what they're discussing? When you say they're a little bit ahead of us on this, I think it's a rare moment for Europe to be ahead of us on anything, but that's a whole different issue.
Right.
So help me understand what you mean by that.
Right. I don't want to swell the Brits' heads. They're a little bit ahead of us, but then they're not. So let me explain what I mean by that. They have passed legislation that's called DRIPA, I don't remember what that stands for, that imposes data retention requirements on communications providers, and that also imposes access requirements that the providers must comply with lawful orders for data that's moving on their network. So they're ahead of us in that they've passed a legislative package that addresses, in part, what we're talking about here. Where they're not ahead of us is they have to figure out, so how will that work when all the providers are in the United States?
Mm-hmm.
And so how will they enforce their legislation if they want data from someone who's located in California and all the infrastructure's in California? How will they actually make that a reality?
Okay. Thank you. You're back.
Senator Risch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Comey, those of us on this committee meet regularly with heads of state and people like you from other countries. Interestingly enough, their top question to us always is, and their top concern to us is similar to what we get from the American press, the American people, and that is that this whole thing has gotten to the point where the most serious problem are these lone wolf people who are either inspired or directed from out of their country to do something. And of course, the most recent and horrific example is what happened in Tunisia just last week. And without, obviously, we are in an open session, I understand that, but I'd like to give you the opportunity to talk to the American people and tell them how what a concern this is for you, how this fits into your priorities, and what you're doing about this in matters that are unclassified. Could you do that for me, please?
Thank you, Senator. ISIL is reaching into the United States, to all 50 states, trying to motivate troubled souls and increasingly kids to either come to their caliphate or kill where you are. And social media, this investment in buzzing in your pocket all day long, actually works. It works to sell shoes. It works to sell cars. It works to motivate troubled souls to do bad things. We are now reaping the results of a year-long effort by ISIL to invest in this social media push, which is why you see so many arrests by the FBI. And these are our disruptions, stopping people from going and shooting innocent people or trying to behead them. And so this is going on all over the place. We're working very, very hard on it. I want the American people to know about it because it's an important thing, but we also need their help. In almost every case, someone saw something. Someone saw something weird that didn't seem right. We got to get folks just to tell us. I mean, human nature is to write an innocent narrative over the hair standing up on the back of your neck and say, I must have misunderstood. He must be having a bad day. Okay, if it's just a bad day, there won't be a problem. We investigate in secret so we don't smear innocent folks. But we got to get folks, when they see something that makes the hair stand up on the back of the neck, say, that guy doesn't seem right, and tell somebody so that we can check it out, right? We need the help. Because this spans all 50 states, we got state and local law enforcement helping us all around the country. We need the good folks of America. They see something that seems out of place, just say something, and we'll check it out. And you can tell any police officer, any deputy sheriff in the entire United States, since 9/11, we have gotten our act together. That information will get within minutes to the right people.
Director Comey, thank you for that, and appreciate what you do and what your organization does. And we all know that you've got to be right every day, 100% of the time. They only got to be right once, and so you're doing a good job. And keep up the good work. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Director, we're going to take just a few more questions, and I just make this note for members: we've got a series of five stack votes starting at 4:30. I want to try to sort of wrap a lot of things that you talked about, because people have asked individual pieces of this question on Going Dark. Is your greatest concern finding the balance between what we ask phone companies or service providers or manufacturers to do to their products or their system, and where the break point is before they become a foreign company versus a domestic company, where I would take from what your folks said to you, when you get to the point you've chased them out of the country, you've just made your problem much worse versus better. Can you help us dissect that?
Yes. The reason this is the hardest problem I've seen in my career in government is we have important public safety issues that we've talked about, that I think everybody agrees are implicated by the universal strong encryption. And then we've got innovation, which is unbelievably important. It's the engine of our amazing country. And we've got security. As a number of senators have said, I care a lot about cybersecurity. I love strong encryption. So how do we take those things we care about, innovation and jobs, security on the internet, and security for ordinary people from crime and terrorism, how do we maximize them all? How do we optimize them all? And as I said, some smart people say, well, if you do anything, it'll destroy the internet or it'll chase all the business overseas. And so I do think we have to engage on the technical solution with smart people and creative people, and we need to think about, is there an international aspect to this? And again, I'm making this up, but ought not the civilized rule of law countries agree upon a framework that makes sense? Sometimes people say to me, well, if we do this for you, we got to do it for China. And my response is, well, if China wants you to do for me, for them, what I want you to do, which is require me to go to an independent judge, show probable cause, get a written order, right, be subject to all this constraint and oversight, that would be great for the Chinese people. I don't think China wants you to do what I want you to do, so I'm less worried about what we agree to being used against us in China, but I am worried about this point that's raised about chasing business to other parts of the Western world, which is why I think we've got to be thoughtful about it.
Well, we certainly we get that part, and we're going to follow that up with some tech company questions at a hearing. Now, before I turn to the vice chairman, I want to give you one opportunity. If there's something you want to share with the American people that you haven't already talked about as it relates to the Bureau, I want to give you the opportunity to do that about your folks at the Bureau and what the Bureau does and why the American people should care whether you're successful.
Well, as I said earlier, we work for the American people. We are. I hope a lot of folks know folks in the Bureau. We're ordinary people who've chosen to do this with our lives. We use the tools you gave us, right? And I'm here not to scare the American people, but to say to the owners of the FBI, I've got a problem. I need help fixing it so that I can continue to do my job. But make no mistake about it, the folks who work for me, we're going to stay at it every single day, round the clock. And if this tool goes away, okay, we'll do our absolute best. But we think it'd be irresponsible not to tell the shareholders, the people who own the FBI, the challenges we're facing so that we can figure out whether we can address it. But my folks, on TV sometimes we look great, sometimes not. In movies sometimes good, sometimes not. In movies the director's often doing exciting things that I would rip an Achilles doing. But we are ordinary people who've chosen not to make a good living, but to make a different kind of life. We love this work. We love working for you, right? And we're simply here to tell you, sort of give you a status report on how's it going with the tools you've given us.
Vice Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. This committee passed out its intelligence authorization bill, I think on June 24th. And in that bill, we put a provision which would require technology companies to inform the appropriate authority when they obtain knowledge of terrorist activity. Now, this is modeled after an existing law which requires technology companies to notify authorities about cases of child pornography, but it doesn't require companies to monitor any user, subscriber, or customer. It is really the beginning of saying, look, Mr. and Mrs. American Technology, you have a responsibility too. What do you think of that?
It's an interesting idea. I've heard about it. My folks have told me about it. I haven't read it or studied it, and so I frankly can't give you an intelligent answer. It's an interesting idea. I do find in practice that they are pretty good about telling us what they see. So I have to give you a non-answer.
It's pretty simple. We do that for child pornography. Don't you think we should do it for possible terrorist acts?
Maybe, but I haven't heard. I'd want to hear out the other side.
Oh, dear.
I want to make sure I'm not missing something. Again, haven't read it. I mean, I'm dumb enough when I know something. This is something I haven't studied enough to give you an intelligent answer.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Comey, one last question. If the United States were to require our companies doing business here to ensure government access to encrypted communications, would you expect that foreign governments would create the same requirement for companies operating there?
I think they might, or might try to.
And I will tell you that, in my view, would clearly be the outcome. I think that would make American individuals and businesses more vulnerable to surveillance by foreign governments. And I just want to leave you with one last thought. I've been on this committee for 14 years, so I kind of get a sense where something is headed. And I think, Mr. Director, where this is headed is towards proposals for some kind of stockpile of encryption keys. I don't think we have it fleshed out where senators are going to want to go, but I get the sense that's where this is going. There should be some kind of stockpile of encryption keys for the government to access. I just want you to know that I'm willing to work with you on ideas here, but I think this proposal is a big-time loser. It's a loser on security grounds for the reasons that I've mentioned. It is a retreat on privacy, and I think it will do great damage to our cutting-edge digital companies that have jobs that pay good wages. So I hope we're not going to go there. I just want you to know my sense, having listened to a couple of hours of this and listening to this morning's testimony, where I think this is headed, and I think it is the wrong way to proceed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Where did you get that this morning?
Senator Heinrich.
Director Comey, you've heard this before, but I want to say it again. Please thank all of your personnel, not just for their efforts in recent weeks, but their efforts that go unsung year in and year out. I want to thank you in particular for the amount of humility that you've shown today. I think it's really helpful at wrapping our heads around how we should proceed on this, because I think the most dangerous thing is to jump to a solution that turns out to be the wrong solution. I have some ideas that I won't share in an open session that I'll share with you and share with my colleagues here about places we should be investing right now to address some of these concerns, and I'll just reiterate, I think we would be making a mistake if we immediately jumped forward and say we passed a law tomorrow that prohibited strong end-to-end encryption with temporary expiring keys. And effectively what we did under that scenario, or at least what I would fear, is that a terrorist or a criminal would simply download an app from Pakistan or somewhere else that would allow them to get around this scenario, and it would put our Americans' data at risk while protecting theirs effectively. And so I think we just need to think through all of that to make sure that at the end of the day we're getting at the people who are causing the problem, and we're not building in weakness into the protection of our own country's data, be it the government or just individuals who expect their financial data, their healthcare data, all the things that we use online now to remain private. So with that, once again, I would ask you to share any final thoughts, and thank you for realizing that there are going to be a lot of questions, and realizing that we're not going to have all the answers immediately, and we shouldn't jump to answers before we completely understand the problem.
Well, thank you, Senator. I agree that something has to be approached carefully. As I said, I think it's the hardest problem I've seen in government. The stakes are very, very high on all sides of this. I think we care about the same things, whether we're from industry or government. And I think that's one of the great things about this country. We do hard stuff. When we talk about it together and figure it out together, especially when the whole effort is around shared values.
I'll leave you with one last thought. We've heard a lot about the amazing innovations of Silicon Valley, and I would tend to agree that, especially on the business front, incredible stuff comes out of there all the time. I think as we seek a solution to some of these things, we should not forget the incredible innovations that come out of our national laboratories. And some of those solutions may make even better sense in this scenario. So thank you once again, Director.
Thanks, Senator Heinrich. I'd think less of you if you didn't get that plug in there on the lab before you left. And I won't speak for the Vice Chairman, but, you know, if anything, I've been a little frustrated that nobody in the administration, no agencies coming up and saying, here's what we think we need. I mean, we've been talking about going dark for some time, and I think you deserve a tremendous amount of credit for your restraint. Don't know that we know the answer yet, therefore we're not laying proposals on the table. We're not up saying, here's a solution we think might work. We'll come when we've got a solution we know will work, we know we can do. So I commend you for that. I haven't heard anybody talk about thousands of keys until today. I'm sure there are some that sit at home at night and are concerned that maybe that's the choice we'll make. If it were that easy, I think we'd already have a solution proposed to us and we'd be considering legislation, and Diane and I would be hashing it out with our members. The fact is that we know that that's not going to meet the test of getting legislation, one, through Congress, two, possibly signed into law. And I think we're just as challenged as you are, Director, about what the solution is. We want to be part of the solution. We want to work with you. I think it's safe to say that we're probably going to have some hearings. They may be closed, they may be open. CEOs of tech companies, the privacy groups, we're going to try to reach out to some experts, not with the belief that we're going to come up with a solution that you haven't come up with, but that we're going to be knowledgeable enough as we go down that road together to write legislation that both sides are confident of where we're going, and we're fairly confident that it's going to be beneficial to the end goal, which is defending the American people. So let me just add one note. When I left prior to the 4th, after doing this now for 15 years, since 2000, I was convinced that we were going to have an incident before I came back this Monday. It didn't happen. And I am convinced it did not happen because the Bureau and the intelligence community worked like it's designed to work. And you asked your folks all around the country to go on a different schedule, and they did, and they were on that tempo for weeks, may still be there. And the fact is that we were able to thwart a lot of things early and maybe postpone some things that might have happened. Your folks deserve a tremendous amount of credit, and the entire intelligence community does. We know this is not going away with the 4th of July. Ramadan stays vibrant for a few more weeks. There'll be another national holiday, and there'll be a target, and we'll pick up on some things. But we also have to recognize the fact that we've got some areas that we're going to be making decisions without the information we've had in the past because of the communication tools that these folks are using. We want to be able to address this as quickly as we can so that we can return to as robust of information sharing between intelligence and law enforcement so that your folks feel confident they can do what they're asked to do versus just hoping that we're putting on a good enough face on Saturday that we're scaring the enemy or the opponent that well. But you deserve a tremendous amount of credit for how over the last 3 or 4 weeks the Bureau has defended the American people. And for that, please give our regards to all at the Bureau. With that, Director, thank you for being here. Sorry that you had to pull a doubleheader today, but you're a strong guy. Yep. And hopefully your Achilles is still there. This hearing's adjourned.